Welcome to Two Bees in a Podcast, brought to you by the Honeybee Research and Extension Laboratory at the University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences. It is our goal to advance the understanding of honeybees and beekeeping, grow the beekeeping community, and improve the health of honeybees everywhere. In this podcast, you'll hear research updates, beekeeping management practices discussed, and advice on beekeeping from our resident experts, beekeepers, scientists, and other program guests. Join us for today's program, and thank you for listening to Two Bees in a Podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Two Bees in a Podcast. And today, Amy and I are really excited to be joined by Leo Rukin, who is a commercial beekeeper here in Florida. The name of his business is Florida Raw LLC. And we're excited, Leo, that you're joining us because we really want to talk about commercial beekeeping, introduce that concept to beekeepers around the world, and they can get a glimpse at how we do it here in Florida. So thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Leo, one of these things that we always do when we have a new guest on the podcast is we always ask those guests to tell a little bit about themselves and how they got into beekeeping in the first place. So could you share a little bit about yourself, you know, how you started keeping bees, if it's been in your family, if it's brand new to you, et cetera?
I grew up around all different types of farming growing up, and my family bought and sold honey was one of our businesses, and they still do that today. So I was around a lot of beekeepers because of that as well. And I just kind of liked it. You know, one of the things that always stuck with me is I would be hanging out on my friend's farm, blueberry farm, and they would have bees. And one day I asked my dad, what was that about? And he's like, oh, the beekeepers drop off their bees and they get paid and they hang out on a farm for a month and then they pick them up. And I was like, well, that sounds great because I already like hanging out on farms. I like bees. So if someone will pay me to do that, that sounds great. So that's honestly kind of just growing up in beekeeping and around farming, it seemed like a good place for me.
Very cool. So can you tell us a little bit about your operation?
Will do. So we are about 60% pollination, 40% honey. And we're so what happened was when I stopped going to school, my family is like very big into education for generations going back. So that I was probably the first person to not finish a college degree in quite some time. And so they were like, okay, if you don't want to go to college, here's three beekeeping outfits that you can work for the next 2 to 3 years before you start yours. And one of them was Billy Rhodes. One of them was the Harveys. And I forget the third one at this time, to be honest, but my dad, I was a kind of a thick-headed kid. And my dad was like, these Harvey guys work so hard that like everyone thinks they're crazy and people will quit. And I was like, well, let me do that. And those guys focused on a lot of pollination and they were kind of the ones that trained me. So then when I got into business, I was focusing on pollination, you know, probably because that's what I had really learned. And you make a lot of honey while you're doing pollination. And then we kind of still get the chance to make most of our honey here. Like we have all of our bees in Florida in the fall when we make our fall crop, and we have all of our bees in Florida when we make our spring crop, which is two of our three crops anyhow. And then we have to keep bees specific for orange. And then we make honey when we're in pollination too. So it all kind of like compiles, but so we do get both. But the reason I fell into more pollination was because I chose to learn from an operation that was involved in a lot of pollination.
Leo, I really think that's a cool story. I've often heard people describe beekeeping as a craft, and like in crafts, they are, you know, people are taught better as an apprentice, right? You actually go and find a mentor and work with them. And I think exactly what you did is of course, you know, one of the best ways to get into commercial beekeeping. You didn't jump straight in. You guys had some experience from your past managing a lot of colonies. Then you went and worked with someone so that you could, you know, learn the tricks of the trade. And now you're out on your own doing it. And the pollination that you mentioned, you know, off the air, you'd mentioned that you're probably about 60% pollination, about 40% honey. Well, one of the things that you use your bees to pollinate is cranberry. Well, they don't grow cranberries here in Florida. So this is a very interesting thing that I'd like to know more about. Could you tell us about using your colonies for cranberry pollination? When does cranberry bloom, a little bit about how it's grown? And like, do you take all your colonies to it, or is just a fraction used for cranberry pollination?
So we take 2,400 hives to cranberry pollination approximately, sometimes a little more, but our base number is 24. Sometimes we'll bump it up like, you know, another 800 or 1,000 hives on occasion. But we really like the 2,400 number because then that keeps, you know, hives at home as well to, you know, make more hives and make honey and different things. But so I'm going to go with the number 24. And cranberry pollination is up north. We're migratory. So we migrate twice a year, once to California and once to cranberries in Wisconsin. So I'll focus on Wisconsin because that was the question. I fell into cranberry pollination because it was always on the list from the people that trained me as well. And then I also had a good friend that went up there and he basically got there and was like, hey, you got to come check this out. It's like 70 degrees during the day, you know? And I was like, that sounds awesome. So we started by sending two loads up there and it's kind of like a notoriously tough pollination. It's in June and July. So it's like very hot. It's kind of a tough time of year for bees in general. And then, you know, the cranberry is like a very, doesn't have a lot of protein in the pollen. It's not a very high, you know, protein. There's not a lot of substance there. So if you want to come out with good bees, you have to subsidize their pollen intake and sometimes feed depending on the time of year. But we generally try to choose bogs that have a lot of as much natural nectar as you can. And some cranberry guys go out and they cut down all of any flower they see to try to get the bees to just go to the cranberry bogs. And some guys actually leave it be. And the people that we work for are very progressive. And so there's like clover all around the bogs, there's basswood in the woods. And kind of what they found is that like, it really just overall keeps the bees closer. It doesn't keep them out of their bogs. Like they actually get a better pollination if they promote other flowers around the bogs too. So that's kind of how I fell into it was I had a friend that just said it was 70 degrees up here. And at the time it was like 101 degrees where I was at in South Florida. So we sent two loads and we drove up there, me and one of my guys to load them up. And when we got there, we were just like, oh, this is amazing. And so then we just kind of amped it up and started sending more bees. By the following year, we were able to, actually it was 3 years later. We did it for 3 years with two loads and then we bumped up to the 2,400. And we're kind of still always working at it and transitioning. Like I think we would like to purchase something there. And then at that point we would ship all of our bees there, hang there until about September, wait for the first frost. So we would do cranberry pollination. Then we would leave and sit in some nectar north of there and then go home because it's a little easier on the bees to ship them versus like the way we're doing it now. We ship them right in June 1st and we're out of there mid-July. And that's a very hot time to ship bees across the country. But they do all right with it, but they would do better if I could hang back for another month and a half.
This idea of taking bees to pollinate something in a bog mm-hmm. is very interesting to a lot of people. Could you just describe that just a little bit?
Yeah, what's a bog?
Okay. I got it. Right. I had to like realize. So we load these bees up in Florida. We put it like 432 to 500 on a semi-truck. And then we ship the semi-trucks into these bogs. The bogs are probably one of the most beautiful agriculture you'll see. It's essentially like a swamp that they've cultivated and controlled. And they'll have like, you know, the bogs we work on are around 800 acres each. And so it's like 800 acres of cranberry beds. And so it's like an intricate road system that goes through these swamps. And you have to stay on the road or you end up in a swamp. And then they also have their holding, like big holding water holding like ponds or, but it's all controlled that they pump out of these bogs and hold their water. So you kind of will drive through these like really beautiful, you know, wet areas where you're like, sometimes you'll do a mile long drive with, you know, 16 feet of road, you know, with 8 feet for two vehicles. And then you're just like in the middle of a lake. Like you kind of feel like you're on a boat, but you're driving a bee truck and then you pop out into the bog. And instead of the lakes, it's these beds of cranberries. And we put out about 2 to 3 beehives per acre, depending on what the farmer wants. And we put them where they ask us to put them. So we'll spread out, you know, so 800 acre bog will take, you know, 1600 hives spread out evenly where they ask me to put them. And then we'll collect them up about a month later, load them back up on the semis and take them home. And that's the gig for cranberry pollination.
I want to know how many times your trucks have gotten stuck. he's like, a lot.
Yeah, we're a lot better at it now than we used to be. Like, you know, we used to get stuck a lot. It almost seemed like it was fun, I think. You know, now we pick a lot better locations. But, you know, our equipment, we're choosing, you know, we choose a truck that's very capable. We run 450s and 550 four-wheel drives. So they're very capable off-road, and then we run, you know, off-road forklifts. So if we do get stuck, we're usually able to just hook up a tow rope real quick and get out of there in a couple of minutes. I've yet to call a farmer for assistance.
Well, Leo, let me sneak one more question in before Amy asks hers. Amy, if you don't mind.
Yeah, sorry. That's fine.
Because this cranberry thing is fascinating to me. And remember, so we have a lot of listeners from around the world who use bees strictly for honey production. So this idea of using bees to provide pollination services is a little odd to them. Moving bees from Florida to Wisconsin, which is not just right down the road, is potentially a little odd to them. I'm curious, since you've been there a few years, what's the price per colony that you've seen over the last few years for pollinating cranberries? Because our listeners may not know that, hey, you know, you're getting paid per colony, have these in there. So what's the price per colony that you've seen over the last few years? And what's the density of colonies per acre that cranberries need?
The price per colony is usually about $85 a hive. It's kind of one of the last pollinations. And then the density is 2 hives per acre, I believe, is what they're going with. Each person is a little different. You know, there's the standard of 2 hives per acre, but then as you get to know your grower more, if he sees that you have like really strong bees, he might reduce the amount of bees that he orders. Or if you have, so they'll taper it to their needs a little bit. But most guys, I think, are just going with 2 hives per acre.
That's awesome. So Leo, I'm thinking about the timeline because I know, as you mentioned, you are migratory. So you go out to California for almond pollination. I assume that's what you go out to California for. And that's usually in January, February for us, right? And then you bring your bees back to Florida and then you bring them up to Wisconsin in the summer. Is that the timeline of your route?
That's correct.
Very awesome. The other question I have, so I'm still like on this cranberry kick, right? I'm super excited because I feel like if I were you, and maybe you feel this way, I'd be super proud every Thanksgiving, you know, when there's cans of cranberry, because you've worked to help make this happen, right? You've helped to put cranberry on people's tables at Thanksgiving here in the United States, which is, I feel like that's something to be proud of.
Right. It is. It really is. I mean, anytime, you know, that I see cranberries or almonds, I definitely feel a connection and feel like it's fun to have done my part to bring those products to the store.
So Leo, I've seen that you've done some YouTube videos. And so I was really excited to see that just because, you know, I know that you were sharing your experiences with the public about just being a commercial beekeeper, what your operation involves. And so that was really kind of cool to see.
Well, we try to have as much fun as you can, to be honest. I think, as you can tell, like a lot of my decisions are just like, you know, of course they have to make sense on paper as well. But I think, and I think all beekeepers do this, it's a cool job because you can taper it to like what you want to do. And like, do I want to be up north in the summer? Do I want to be here making honey? And those types of things.
Do you feel like that's an important part of your operation as far as just sharing your knowledge?
Well, I feel that the YouTube videos were me trying to do that. Like, I definitely wanted to share the knowledge and share the experience of being a Florida migratory beekeeper, because I think it is a really cool way to make a living. And like, not everybody is, you know, there's a lot of indoor, you know, careers that are pushed towards people. Not a lot of people are like, you should become an electrician, or you should become a farmer, or you should do these other things. But some people should, and they can do very, very well with it. And so that was kind of why I started doing those videos. I'm not very good at like making them, so I was paying for a service. And we did 1 year of it. And that was kind of the idea, really, is to just kind of show people what we do and try to get you know, get people to think it's cool, maybe influence some kids to get into beekeeping because it is right. a lot of fun and a good career.
So Leo, this question is actually very near and dear to me because I know commercial beekeeping is not without peril and stress and strategy. So I'm curious from your perspective, because all commercial beekeepers talk with one another and you all know what the other's doing. What are the biggest challenges you feel the whole industry faces, the commercial beekeeping industry? And then as an added question, I'm curious how you would answer this for yourself. So again, what do you think are the biggest challenges in commercial beekeeping? And then what are your own personal biggest challenges in the industry that you run?
I think that the biggest challenges are mites and lack of floral source. And I think that they're connected, really. I think that the mites is probably the biggest player on being a thorn in my side for sure. And they are in a time right now where they're a little harder to deal with than they have been in the past. But there's a lot of good people working on it. And I think beekeepers are becoming more aware. And instead of just kind of like doing things on schedule and not really knowing the effects we're having, I think a lot of the beekeepers like myself are getting more like data orientated where we're actually doing mite rolls throughout our operation before and after treatments on a regular basis. You know, and just kind of trying to understand the mite more, because that really is the biggest enemy. And it's sometimes you have to factor in if you're in springtime and you're making a lot of bees, you're also going to be creating mites. So even if you're treating, you could still have a little higher mite load just because of the fact that you have so many bees in the boxes too from that. Just kind of understand the mite better, because I think that's the number one. That's what's killing the bees for the most part is the mites. So that's the biggest toughie out there.
Yeah, definitely, Leo. And you also mentioned floral sources. I know that, and I don't know if we've mentioned this yet in the podcast, but you are in a couple of different counties. So you're in a couple of different areas in South Florida. Something that we've heard recently is just the lack of land, you know, and development that's happening. And so do you feel like that is also a factor? Is lack of land also an issue?
Not for us, really. There's plenty of people that like to support bees, and we've got plenty of space and plenty of flowers.
Sounds good. Is there anything else that you wanted to add, Leo?
That's it, really.
Well, Leo, that was great. I really appreciate you taking some time to come share with our listeners about your beekeeping operation. It's very inspirational, and I hope folks around the world can really take some nuggets of truth that you are willing to share and allow that to permeate their own strategy to keeping bees. So thank you so much. Good luck with your continued business growth, and I appreciate you joining us.
Thanks for having me. You guys have a great day, Amy and Jamie.
So Jamie, you know, I personally love talking to migratory beekeepers. I love learning the routes that they have across the nation, especially when it comes to pollination. And most of the time it is for pollination so that they can work with growers and the growers can produce the crop. And of course, that ends up on our table, right? And so normally, a lot of times when we are talking about the United States, we're talking about almond pollination because that's huge in our industry. But cranberry pollination is such a niche specialty crop. And I was really excited to learn about cranberry pollination. I didn't know what a bog was before, you know, we had discussed that. And, you know, let's talk a little bit about migratory beekeeping and how far that actually is. So, you know, we're talking about trucking bees from Florida to Wisconsin, like Leo mentioned. How far is that? I mean, it's like, how many stops do you have to take for that?
Yeah, he probably takes quite a few stops. Actually, these guys are professional. He just mentioned that he put, 400 and something to 500 and something colonies on the back of a semi truck. Mm-hmm. And so for our listeners around the world, you know, we in the U.S., and I know it's common in Europe and some places like Australia, it's popular to move bees all around the country for the purpose of pollination. And he said, for example, he moves his bees from Florida, southern Florida, specifically to Wisconsin. Well, for our U.S. listeners, that's about 1,300 miles. For our listeners from around the world, that's about 2,000 kilometers. So he's throwing, you know, 400, 450, 500 colonies on the back of a truck, and they're trucking them 2,000 kilometers to get to Wisconsin from here. For California, that's about 2,500 miles or 4,000 kilometers. So it takes a few days to get bee colonies going that far. And there's quite a lot involved in the process, but it's very common to truck bees around the nation. You heard Amy, what he said about cranberry prices, right? He gets about $85 a colony. He also said it's one of the latest pollinated plants that they go to. And what he means by that is by the time he gets his colony to cranberries, they've probably already gone to two or three or four other crops. And, you know, they're picking up pollination, essentially rent each of those stops. And by the time they get to cranberries, you know, he said 2,400 colonies, he's putting them out at $85 a colony. You do the math. And so you multiply that by four or five different crops and think about the fact that he also does honey production. He's moving his bees far, but he's moving bees far because it's profitable.
Right. It's profitable, but there are all, you know, always those underlying costs as well. So I want to transition a little bit over to this, the stocking density. This is a question that I've been receiving pretty often, actually. So just how many colonies per acre? And I feel like it's pretty standard, and you can disagree with me if I'm incorrect, but it's pretty standard for 2 to 3 colonies, right, per acre?
It does vary by crop. There was a really neat book by Daniel Mayer and Keith Thelplane years ago, Crop Pollination by Bees. And I've heard rumors that he's redoing that. So maybe it's out or will be coming out at any point now. But in it, they had chapters listed alphabetically by crop. So, you know, apple, avocado, things like that. And they were putting, they were exploring the literature to see what research has shown the number of colonies needed for each of those crops per acre. And to our listeners from around the world, I apologize. In America, we still use acres. But you're right. It is about 2 to 3 colonies per acre for a lot of crops. And so he mentioned that it was about 2 colonies per acre for cranberries. That's roughly, very roughly, about 1 colony per hectare. So for every hectare of cranberries grown, it takes about 1 colony to pollinate that. So you can do the math.
Very cool. All right. Well, if you are in the United States and you had cranberries for Thanksgiving, you can thank a beekeeper.
Yeah, I think that was one of the coolest points you made, Amy, while you were with him, is if you're a beekeeper, especially a commercial beekeeper, and you know the crops that you're using to provide pollination for, you can know when you get that food at the table that's dependent on your bees. And that's, of course, why beekeepers are so important. So it was really neat to hear him share that and really neat to hear you make that point.
It's everybody's favorite game show, Stump the Chump.
Hello, and welcome back to the question and answer time. So we are on the continuation of talking about pollen subs and honeybee nutrition. So for this segment, the first question, Jamie, that we have, I'm just going to read the question and then I'll summarize afterwards. But would the process of bees using dyed pollen sub for brood food change the appearance of dye in the brood mass? So would changing dyed pollen sub into brood food erase the color of the dye? You know, tell me why someone would want to dye their pollen subs for any reason. I'd love to hear.
Yes. So, Amy, this goes back to a presentation I did for the Stay at Home Beekeeping series, which is an online monthly series managed mainly out of Auburn University, but with collaborators from other land grant universities and USDA labs in the southeastern U.S. And I was giving a talk on the science of using pollen subs. And in that talk, I explained a particular research project that we undertook in which we were asking the question, when pollen subs disappear in a hive, where do they go? And the reason we were asking this question is we wanted to know if bees use pollen subs the same way they use pollen. And how do they use pollen? Well, adult bees eat pollen. Adult bees feed pollen to developing workers and drones, and then they will store it as bee bread. So if bees use pollen subs the way that they use pollen, we would expect to find pollen subs in adult bees, immature bees, and bee bread. And the way that Emily Nordyke, a former master student in our lab, looked at that is she dyed the pollen subs and looked in adult bees and in brood and in bee bread for evidence of dyed pollen subs. The premise being, if we found dyed pollen subs in these three areas, then we'd have reason to believe bees were using it the same way they'd use pollen. Well, guess what? We only found the dyed pollen sub in adult bees. So we concluded from that, that they don't use pollen sub the way that they use pollen. It looks like only adult bees use it. It's not stored as bee bread, and it doesn't go into the feed fed to larvae. So the questioner is then saying, well, what if it's possible that when the adult bees took in the pollen sub that's dyed, that in the adult bee, it lost the dye before it was passed on to the immature bee? And that's an entirely feasible possibility. So maybe we're saying they don't feed pollen subs to larvae just because our dye isn't transferred from pollen sub to adult bee to larvae. So we tried to control for that by having sugar patties that we dyed, and we ended up finding dyed larvae in the colonies that we provided dyed sugar patties. So the adult bees were eating the dyed sugar patties and feeding that to the larvae, and the dye was not being broken down in that transition from patty to bee to larva. And we also found dyed bee bread because the bees were moving that sugar patty into the bee bread as they were packaging the pollen that was coming into the nest. So this leads me to believe that the dye is stable in the gut of the bee as she takes it from a patty and takes it and passes it on to the larvae. Long story short, we have reason then to believe that if the bees were giving pollen sub to larvae, we would have seen it. We don't think the dye would have broken down because our positive control patties, the sugar patties, we were in fact seeing that dye in the larvae. Now, we could still be wrong. You could argue that there's a biochemical reaction that happens with the dye in pollen subs that doesn't happen with the dye in sugar patties. But, you know, often the simplest explanation is the best. And at the moment, we're running with the idea that they're not in fact passing pollen subs to the bees, and that it's not an artifact of the dye breaking down, but it's just an artifact of the fact that bees aren't passing it to larvae.
All right. So for our second question, so the person is wondering, you know, as just the average home beekeeper, if you were just a beekeeper, and let's say that you were a hobbyist beekeeper, had hives in your backyard, can you still be successful as a beekeeper by not feeding?
Okay, so there's the short answer and the long answer. And the short answer is yes. And the long answer is, you know, a typical Jamie answer, which is long. But let me set the stage this way. Again, going back to this presentation that I give, the science of using pollen subs, one of the grand conclusions of the multiple research projects that we do here is that, you know, I question the efficacy of pollen subs in general. And because of that, my general recommendation is if I were a commercial beekeeper, until we know more, I probably wouldn't change my approach to using pollen subs very much, because if I felt like I was getting a positive benefit using them, I would probably continue to use them until there's even more data. Although I feel like the data growing at the moment's pretty substantial, I still feel like bees do get a little bit of benefit from pollen subs, and certainly under some environmental conditions and management strategies, they may be beneficial. The only difference is if I were a commercial beekeeper, I would always want to know if they worked. So I'd hold back 10% or so of my colonies that didn't receive the subs so that I can have something to compare the colonies that did receive the subs to, just to make sure that I'm actually getting my money's worth out of feeding these subs. All right, so that's point one. But point two, the individual says, can the average home beekeeper be a successful beekeeper without using pollen subs or supplemental feeding? The answer is an overwhelming yes. In fact, I would argue that most hobbyists never have a reason to feed a pollen sub. Now, the individual did say supplemental feeding, so I'm going to make sure that I'm not reading too much into pollen subs and them saying, well, maybe the sugar syrup thing's an issue too. So let me just say this again. I don't think the average hobbyist beekeeper will ever need to use a pollen sub. If you're getting a lot of diversity in pollen color, you know, throughout much of the production season coming into your colonies and bees seem to be doing just fine, then you're probably okay. But in contrast to that, I would say the average hobbyist beekeeper will need to feed carbohydrates to their bees. If not, you know, most years, at least some years. And what do I mean by that? I feel that the average hobby beekeeper is going to have to feed their bee sugar syrup at some point. You know, maybe they don't have enough food stored in fall to survive winter. You're going to need to feed sugar syrup. Maybe they didn't have a great spring and they're running out of food in summer and can't get to the fall nectar flow. You're going to need to feed sugar syrup. So the average hobbyist is going to need to feed sugar syrup at some point in a colony's life. But the average hobbyist, in my opinion, is not going to need to feed a pollen sub at some point in the colony's life.
All right. I think that's great advice. I'm laughing because you prefaced by saying that, you know, the short answer is yes. But also you have the long answer. And if you didn't have long answers, this podcast would be way shorter than it actually
is. Yeah, I guess. I think one of the benefits is that our podcast is we try very hard to put the science behind it. So it's easy to just say yes or no, or maybe or not. But I want to make sure folks understand the reasoning behind what I say. And it also gives them the opportunity to disagree with my answer. Some people say, well, gosh, I don't care what you say. I've seen overwhelming evidence that these things are mm-hmm. beneficial. So we need to use them. So I just like to provide some of the reason behind. And this is one of those, it's a clear yes or no answer to me, but it's important to know why it's clear to me.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
So for our last question, the question is, do drones eat pollen or bee bread? We know that drones get kicked out at some point, especially during times when they're dearth or, you know, I guess up north where they have snow in wintertime. But are the drones eating the pollen as well?
Yes. And so I think this goes to a larger question about the idea that bees add pollen to immature bees' food. And so let me back up and kind of answer this question the long way, right? After we just had that dialogue about it. So we know when a queen lays an egg, out of that egg will come a young larvae. That young larvae feeds on brood food, or royal jelly more specifically, that nurse bees produce in glands in their head. So the nurse bees are producing royal jelly. Every larva gets royal jelly the first 24 to 72 hours of their life. Around 48 to 72 hours, the nurse bees will transition away from feeding workers and drones royal jelly and to feeding workers and drones brood food. So just very quickly, the nurse bees have two sets of glands in their head, hypopharyngeal and mandibular glands, that produce different components of the food that they feed their young. So the ratio of the hypopharyngeal gland to mandibular gland secretions is the difference between royal jelly and brood food. So the larvae that they want to make queens, they will continue feeding royal jelly. The larvae that they want to make workers, or the larvae destined to become drones, will start receiving brood food, which is just a different ratio of hypopharyngeal and mandibular gland secretions. So as the worker and drone larvae age, that brood food is diluted with pollen and nectar increasingly, so that when the larvae are very old worker larvae and drone larvae, they are getting a high proportion of nectar or honey and pollen in their brood food. So yes, developing drones are fed pollen or bee bread mixed into their larvae the same way workers are fed pollen or bee bread mixed into their food as they age. So as I talk about increasingly bees mixing in pollen into the food that the developing workers and drones are fed, there is this kind of general idea bubbling up that do bees really put pollen into worker and drone food? And the research literature says yes. I mean, I've seen the literature. There's not a ton of literature on this topic, but there is literature on this topic where scientists have seen this. And so it's definitely mixed into the brood food of workers and drones. But I will say it's also a topic that's open-ended at the moment, where there's more work that can be done. And the reason it's of interest to me, because we often try to look at pesticide exposure that worker and drone larvae have while developing. And if they get it, it would probably be coming into the nectar or the pollen that's mixed into their food. So it is an important topic. So at the moment, we defer to, yes, it is being mixed into their food, but it's definitely an area that needs to have more research.
Yeah, Jamie, I think it's definitely true. There's always, like you mentioned, and you've mentioned a couple of times now, nutritional research on bees is just such a great opportunity to, you know, to get into. And there's just so much potential for growth and what we're finding out about honeybee nutrition. So it'll be exciting to see, you know, where honeybee nutrition changes in the next decade or two, or even less than that, I think. All right, everybody, those are the questions that we have for the Q&A for today. We may or may not sprinkle in more nutrition questions in our future Q&As, but if you have other questions or if you have any comments about our episode, please feel free to let us know on our email or on one of our social media pages. Hello, everyone. Thanks for listening to today's episode. This episode was edited and produced by our podcast coordinator, Mitra Hamzabi. Thanks, Mitra.
Visit the UF IFAS Honeybee Research and Extension Laboratory's website, ufhoneybee.com, for additional information and resources for today's episode. Email any questions that you want answered on air to honeybee@ifas.ufl.edu. You can also submit questions to us on X, Instagram, or Facebook, at UF Honeybee Lab. Don't forget to follow us while you're visiting our social media sites. Thank you for listening to Two Bees in a Podcast.